Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guests today are Melissa Michelson and Brian Harrison. Melissa is a professor of political science at Menlo College in California. Brian is a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University and has also held positions in the federal government. The two are co-authors of a new book titled Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Melissa, Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, you've done some social experiments aimed at understanding how people think about same-sex marriage and then respond to different appeals concerning same-sex marriage. So, Melissa, start with you. Could you briefly summarize that research?
Yeah. What our idea is that if you appeal to somebody on the issue and you tell them that somebody who's a member of their group or somebody they look up to, so maybe a leader of their religious group or a star of their favorite football team, and you say, you know, this person supports same-sex marriage, that maybe opens them up to thinking about the issue in a different way.
So your experiments then were to take some people and to talk to them in different ways and then look at how they responded afterwards? Was that the basic method?
It's more that we're randomly dividing people into groups and saying some things to some people and a different thing to other people, and then comparing who says what in response.
But, okay.
Yeah.
And Brian, what's the overall goal of the project? I mean, why are you trying to do this, I guess?
Well, I think there's a theoretical goal. We added to theory to say that, you know, people tend to like people who are in an identity group that they share more. They tend to trust them more. They tend to listen to them more. And our goal was really to extend that to say, you know, if you can show that you share an identity with someone and then talk to them about an issue that isn't related to that identity, they'll also find you more persuasive. So the purpose of the book, Listen, We Need to Talk, is it's important for people to talk to those in their social circles, even about issues that might be contentious political issues, social issues, because that's really where attitude change happens. And when you talk with people who, you know, you share something with, you might be able to move them forward on LGBT rights as well.
So, and that's what I wanted to get at. And this may seem like either a dumb or simplistic question to the two of you, but I do want to put it out there. So is the goal of your book to move ultimately to help people move thinking in one direction on this issue? It sounds like it's toward more acceptance of more LGBT rights. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And much of the work was done in cooperation with advocacy organizations around the country. So we're very much trying to move people to be more supportive of LGBT rights. And in none of the work do we try to move people against.
Okay. And I imagine those who would not want to advance those rights beyond where they are now or have concerns might take the lessons from your book and say, well, we will apply this in the way that we talk to people. Is that correct?
Sure. And theoretically, that would also work, although we do not advocate doing that.
I understand. Okay. Well, let me, before we get into more details about exactly what you found, and Melissa, you gave us some hints about that earlier. I want to talk about some of the recent historical context for this. And I have read, and it's been my own experience as an observer of society over the years, that the views toward LGBT rights in recent years, but particularly lesbian and gay rights, have changed dramatically. And they've changed dramatically fast compared with past civil rights efforts. So first of all, Brian, you're nodding your head, but is that impression correct? Is my impression there correct?
It is, particularly on marriage equality. So generally speaking, public opinion changes very slowly over time. And if you look at public opinion about abortion, for example, from 1977 until today, you know, things waxed and waned, but generally they're where they were in the late 70s. If you look at public opinion since 1996 on marriage equality or same-sex marriage, it has support has increased dramatically over the last 20 or so years. And that really was the motivating question for our book. Why is that? And what are some potential explanations? In the book, we point to some explanations that others use that aren't as plausible. Things like cohort replacement, where simply older people who held more conservative views are dying and are being replaced by younger, more progressive people. That actually doesn't explain all of the change. And what we point to is this idea of identity group leaders really, you know, moving their identity groups forward by coming out as LGBT supporters, as marriage equality supporters. and point to that as really the driver of a lot of the opinion change that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years or so.
And are there any, Melissa, are there any other factors that are important other than the one that Brian mentioned there about opinion leaders taking on these positions?
Well, there are a couple other big explanations. One of them is interpersonal contact. Just people finding out, like, hey, somebody I already know and love is a member of this community. So Dick Cheney finds out that his daughter is a lesbian. He becomes a supporter of same-sex marriage. And there's also paracontact, that people are seeing gay and lesbian characters on television. Hmm. And so they kind of develop relationships with those media characters. So there's other things going on as well. There's advocacy campaigns being waged all over the country. So there are multiple explanations. There's not one reason for this rapid change that we've seen.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Brian Harrison and Melissa Michelson, authors of the new book, Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. So, Brian, let's get into the findings in a little bit more detail. So what did you discover about how people react to different kinds of appeals concerning same-sex marriage? Melissa mentioned before, if there's someone that I'm inclined to think of as my tribe or my group, and they're respected by me, and I know that you tell me that they have this view, that that's going to help me move. Break that down a little bit more detail for me.
Sure. We have four identity chapters. We look at race and ethnicity. We look at religion. We look at partisanship, and we look at sports identity and identity as a fan of a particular sports team. So each chapter breaks down these identities, and we appeal to them in different ways in each. But I'll give you a concrete example. We ran an experiment, a social experiment in Chicago, working with Equality Illinois, and they wanted to know how to reach the black community in Chicago, in the Cook County area. So what we did was we had a list of black people in the area that we purchased, and callers either appealed to black identity through a quotation from Coretta Scott King, appealing to them as, you know, a member, a leader of our community supports marriage equality, and therefore so should you. And our hypothesis was, you know, a black recipient of this call should identify more with the call if they think that there's this common link, if there's this identity in common. And we did experiments, again, around Latino identity. We did experiments around religious identity and partisanship. And I think the most interesting set of experiments were around identity as a sports fan. If you appeal to people, for example, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, we pointed out that Leroy Butler, who was a Hall of Famer, very well known in the Green Bay area, was a supporter of same-sex marriage. And when you spoke to a Packers fan, that was meaningful to them, that moved their opinion in a way that didn't move opinion for someone who was not a fan of the team. Hmm. So again, if you can find an identity, even if it's seemingly superficial, as a Green Bay Packer fan.
I don't think they would regard that as superficial.
Not at all. But if you can find an identity that's relevant, that's salient, that's important to someone, you can move opinion even on something that's unrelated to that identity at all.
So how powerful were the results? I mean, give me an idea of the magnitude of the difference in effect between one approach versus the other approach.
It depended on, obviously, the experiment, but I think our most robust findings were between 12 and 15 percentage points change in support from the control to the treatment. And I believe that was sports fans, actually, or religion. I don't remember off the top of my head.
For the Green Bay Packers fan, we moved people from 63% support to 78% support if they were a Green Bay Packer fan and they heard the idea that Packers Hall of Famer Leroy Butler was a supporter. They went from 63 to 78.
So that can make a real difference in terms of voting behavior then, if something is put to a referendum or just in terms of support of court decisions. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. And there is some evidence of that. Black opinion shifted dramatically when Barack Obama came out in support of same-sex marriage in May of 2012. And in the fall of 2012, we saw black public opinion reflected in popular referenda on same-sex marriage that was in several states, including Maryland. So their black support for marriage equality reflected that shift in opinion that had occurred back in May.
And either of you jump in on this, but I was curious as to what the two of you think about the broader implications of your findings and your work for understanding more generally how people think about this issue. Is there a bigger link that you see there, Brian? You're shaking your head.
I think there is. I think it's important to remind people that LGBTQ people live in their community, that they interact with them on a daily basis. And particularly in the current political climate, it's easy to think of us versus them. And we're encouraged to think that way every day and through media coverage and interactions we have with people. But at the end of the day, the message is that there is truly more that unites us than divides us. And I think reminding people, you know, people who think about the world the way you do, people who live with you, people who do the things that you do, either are LGBT or are supporters of LGBT rights. It doesn't change opinion overnight, for sure, but it does sort of chip away at the idea that those people are fundamentally different from me. It reminds people that, you know, my neighbors, those with whom I see on a regular basis, that I share values and that I see on a regular basis, are more like me than they aren't. And that includes things like LGBT rights. And again, I think it's easy to assume that there are, you know, divides that can't be bridged, and I fundamentally disagree. And I think our book shows the beginning of that view, even in current politics.
Do you have thoughts about that, Melissa, the bigger implications of your work for how people think about these things?
Yeah, I think what it's saying is you shouldn't be afraid to talk to people about stuff because there is room for people to change their minds. It's kind of this optimistic message of kind of building on what Brian said, like, we're not necessarily so divided. Like, you know, we bond over rooting for the San Francisco Giants, or we bond as members of the same church. And, you know, we have something in common here, and maybe that can help us overcome our political differences as well and just start talking about things that are contentious, like LGBT rights and other contentious issues, and maybe reduce some of that polarization out there.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Melissa Michelson and Brian Harrison. We've been discussing how people think about same-sex marriage and how those views might change. They have a new book out on the topic titled Listen, We Need to Talk. Brian, over recent years, I have heard this issue of marriage referred to in several different ways. Gay marriage, same-sex marriage, the term I'm using today, and marriage equality. Does it matter which of those terms get used?
It does matter, and we know words matter, framing matters. So another example, the estate tax and death tax. Well, who's for taxing someone who just died? People may not know what estate tax is. So the framing of what you call an issue absolutely matters. When you talk about gay marriage, it focuses on difference. If you yourself do not identify as gay, that isn't something that you can relate to. Even same-sex marriage sort of accentuates the differences between a same-sex couple and an opposite-sex couple. But marriage equality really speaks to the idea that a same-sex marriage and an opposite-sex marriage are, in fact, the same.
And Melissa, you wanted to jump in on this. Go ahead.
Well, it also matters because I've found that some people, when you say marriage equality, they think, oh, that the wife and the husband should have equal power and equality in the relationship. So sometimes, unfortunately, using the term marriage equality doesn't help because people don't realize what you're really talking about.
Does that push you forward or push you back? That assumption.
That there. I don't know, but it confuses them, and we don't want to confuse people.
So I want to get into this other issue that is on the table right now for the country. There's this debate that's going on currently over the use of public bathrooms and which bathrooms transgendered individuals should be permitted to use. So, Melissa, do you think your research suggests anything about how that discussion should go? Is that something you folks are looking at right now?
We're looking at that issue and how to advance transgender rights, but it's very different because people respond very differently to transgender people. There's a lot of fear and discomfort when it comes to interacting with a transgender person. And so that fear is the way people were responding to gay people maybe 20 years ago. And as advocates, we don't think we should have to wait 20 years for transgender people to be able to pee. And so we're kind of looking for a different way to approach it. Like, can we get people to have less anxiety and thus less bias against transgender people? Maybe the same thing will work and maybe something different will work. And we're starting to do experiments on that.
Okay. And as I think about this, question I put, Brian, I guess I'll put it to you, but as I'm thinking through the debate, as I'm listening to it, it seems to me the logical conclusion of this solution perhaps might be just moving toward just unisex bathrooms with some kind of enhanced privacy features inside those bathrooms to protect whatever people are worried about from happening, or where possible, a series of individual bathrooms versus these larger public. It's not, I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is it's not like we're going to check someone's transgendered card before they go into a bathroom. I mean, do you have thoughts about that? It might seem like a silly question, but as I think about how to solve this, that's where my mind goes.
I think that's the solution a lot of people point to. And actually, that was what was done with Gavin Grimm at his school in Virginia. He requested to use the bathroom that matched his gender identity, and their resolution was to create a unisex bathroom that he could use. And he used it for a bit, as I understand. But his argument was, I don't want a different bathroom. I don't need anything that's special. I'm simply a boy, and I deserve to use a boy's bathroom. And I think the idea of having a, you know, genderless bathroom or a unisex bathroom really misses the point in that transgender people aren't seeking anything special. They simply want the same thing that everyone else has. And we shouldn't let people's fear or sense of threat to really dictate public policy when, again, transgender people just want to go where everyone else goes.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guests are Brian Harrison and Melissa Michelson. Well, Melissa, now, pushing on this a little bit harder, some folks have expressed concerns over this issue by pointing to what it might mean for eligibility for gender-specific programs and sources of aid, such as various grants or participation on sports teams. There's already been a case or two involving that, and even the choice of what prison you're going to be incarcerated in. So how do you see this topic and what we're learning about it applying to those issues? Is there a connection? How do you sort that out?
I don't think it's going to be the same on every issue. I think, for example, if you think about the young man who just won the state wrestling championship in Texas, people are going to have a different reaction to that because now they're thinking about, well, what's fair for my girls or what's fair for the other girls in the state who want to compete if now there's this boy who's competing against them? And they might then be more willing to change their attitude and say, yes, he should compete as a boy. Folks in prison, though, there's not a lot of sympathy for folks in prison. And I think it's much harder to get people to think in a way about prisoners that will advance transgender rights of prisoners. They can't feel as much empathy for those people, really. They can't quite get their minds around it in the same way. So I think we'll advance on different things quicker than others.
Brian, you wanted to jump in on this. Go ahead.
I also think it points out how gendered our society really is. And it isn't just about bathrooms. And hopefully we can look at it in a larger standpoint in that women still don't earn the same pay as men, generally speaking. And we do sort of artificially treat men and women differently. We choose to treat them differently. And transgender bathrooms is one example where we really look at the gendered spaces that we have in our culture. And I hope that it's a part of a broader conversation to really say, well, we really don't – maybe we don't need to fund things differently because of the gender of the athlete. Maybe it can be part of a conversation where we realize that everyone should be funded and treated equally in every space, not just bathrooms.
And this is a question for both of you, but it's the big picture question. And I've left a bit of time here because I really want to get into this with both of you. Where do you see the nation headed? Because you've been thinking a lot about this, obviously, and you've had a lot of interactions with different people talking about these issues. So where do you see the nation headed in the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years? We're going to take this beyond the Trump administration, okay? So however long that may last, I want you to think further on LGBT rights. Is there a new frontier that you see out there that we're not talking about now that you think we're going to be talking about in the future? Brian, you want to jump in on this?
I think a few things. I think we had the sense that LGBT rights were on a forward progressive trajectory, and that change was inevitable. And all of a sudden in November, we saw that isn't the case. So I think if you would have asked me a year ago, my answer would have been, I think we'll continue progressing in a pro-LGBT rights direction, and we will see a lot of the things that we have seen resolve in the next 5 to 10 years. I don't necessarily feel that way anymore. I think it reminds us all that change is hard, and change comes in fits and starts. And so I think, you know, I know we're looking beyond the Trump administration, but I think we can't in some regard, because I think it's become more socially acceptable to express transphobic, particularly, but also homophobic views. And that will set back policy in the short term, which will then sort of affect the longer term. I don't know that there's necessarily a longer frontier or a different issue in the long term, because it took so long for LG rights to advance the way that they did. And I think a lot of people think this, you know, this question is a new one, and it really isn't. If you look throughout the 20th century, the Senate was really tackling what they called homosexuals in government in the 1930s. There was the Lavender Scare in the 1940s and 50s to try to purge the federal government of homosexual men because they were a threat to national security. So I think a lot of people see the, you know, the fight for LGBT rights as really the last 15, 20 years. And in reality, it's been 80, 90 years of fighting. It just has not been in the forefront. So I think, unfortunately, we will have a longer fight on the you know, array of LGBTQ issues that we see. And it's not just marriage. It's parenting laws. It's bullying laws. It's employment non-discrimination. And, of course, it is transgender rights. So I wish I could say I see in 10 or 15 years that LGBTQ people would be treated equally under the law. And I hope that's true. But looking at history, I think it will be a long time before the even the issues that we currently see will be resolved. And I hope there aren't new ones, because we have plenty that we need to address right now.
So, Melissa, we've only got about a minute left, but what's your view on this? Do you see a new frontier out there, or your sense of the long-term history here?
I agree with Brian that this is really a long-term battle for equality, and, you know, maybe we'll get some progress on bathroom access. But there are so many things that folks are fighting for. But then there also are kind of newer groups that are coming to public attention, people who are asexual or pansexual, or they're not transgender, but they're just gender nonconforming. And our definition of gender is kind of exploding into a bazillion different categories. And you can choose from, I think, 20 odd ways to identify your gender on some social media platforms. And so it's going to be slow, and moving civil rights is slow, moving the nation is slow. But at the same time, I am fairly optimistic, because we have seen so much shift on marriage equality, and we have seen some great advances. And I think, although sometimes it can be a two steps forward, one step back when it comes to social movements, the arc moves towards expanded rights and more justice. So I'm feeling like we're making some progress, even if it takes, you know, another 80 years.
You're with Martin Luther King on the arc.
Pretty much,
right.
Yeah. Arc of justice is long.
That was Melissa Michelson and Brian Harrison. Once again, their new book is titled Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Brian, Melissa, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.